as we get to the very end of the book, Sefer Bereishit, so there's a couple of leftover strands that I want to try to tie up. Primarily, I still want to deal with Yosef. You know, I've been accused of, I've been accused of many things, but one of the things that I was accused of is by some woman who, I won't name her now, but she'll know who she is, who claims to have listened to 400 or 500 of my classes, and she claims that Yosef is my favorite character. I don't know, because I've never listened to those classes, so I lose track, but there are certain things about Yosef which we do think are quite attractive, but as we noticed, not everybody really finds Yosef so impressive. So let's take a look. Who does find Yosef impressive? Well, basically, everybody. You're raising your hands. Okay. I'll try to let you know when these are rhetorical questions. Who does find Yosef attractive? Oh, I don't want to say attractive, because now you're going to go in a whole other direction with that. Who does find Yosef impressive? And that's essentially everybody who meets him. And wherever Yosef is, Yosef immediately rises to the top. And that's something that we've seen. And presumably, this is something which troubles the brothers greatly. Now, I do want to focus this in a way that maybe I haven't said precisely before. So some of these things I have, but you'll see in a moment. Have you ever heard this midrash that says that the brothers put Yosef on trial? They had a trial, and they found him guilty for being married by Malchut. By the way, I've heard of the midrash as well, and I'm unable to find it. I'm unaware of any primary source that says that there was actually a formal trial and they found him guilty, and therefore, but what was he guilty of? They claimed that he was guilty of what we can call trying to usurp the kingship from Yehuda. And the fact that Yehuda becomes king is something that we don't find out till this week's parsha, that Yehuda doesn't become king. If I look at the power structure within the family, and this is a very complicated, and most likely we can use the term dysfunctional family, but we have two different primary wives, Rachel and Leah, and Rachel's oldest son is Reuven, who perhaps should be the one who's leader. If you look at Unculus right over here, when he gets his quote-unquote bracha, Leah's oldest son. When you look at Unculus, Reuven b'chori ata, right there he says, as being b'chor, you should have gotten this, this, and this. You should have gotten the kingship. You should have gotten the kahuna. You should have gotten the double portion. Reuven should have been the one. He's really the firstborn. Reuven ends up becoming disqualified, right, for his particular sin. Right, and as I've said before, I know the Gemara says it. Whoever says Reuven sins is making a mistake. You know, Elotoa. So apparently Yaakov doesn't know this, because Yaakov seems to think that he has sinned, and really spells it out quite clearly in this week's parasha. I suspect that when the Gemara says whoever says this is Toa, it doesn't mean that he never did it. It just means that you shouldn't say it, because he did tshuva. He did tshuva. He's not supposed to remind about tshuva of what they've done. But it doesn't say he didn't do it. Of course he did it. Anyway, stop with that. I actually am afraid that he's going to hear it here, but there was somebody who was upset with me for something that I said. Don't worry, it was you. No, that's not. No, somebody was upset with me and saying that my treatment of Yosef of the brothers is that I treated them as if they're human beings, and these were great tzaddikim. You can't say these negative things about them. The great tzaddikim, how can you say these things? So I sent him the Medrash. I said, the Medrash says this, this, and this about Yehuda. It's far worse than what I said. He goes, yeah, but they were great tzaddikim. They're allowed to say this. So I guess I'm... The truth is, the only response to that is I should have admitted that I'm a great tzaddik, and I can say it. The truth is, I do absolutely understand the sensitivity, and this is a problem that we constantly have. Because on the one hand, if these people, our biblical heroes, if we totally deconstruct and reduce them to the point that they are common criminals, then we have a problem. And one of the great things within the children of Yaakov is, despite all the problems, because again, look at it objectively, what exactly did Yishmael do that was so bad that he gets kicked out of the house? What exactly did Esav do which was so bad? Don't tell me Midrashim, tell me the text. What did Yishmael and Esav do that they get kicked out? What did Lot do which was so bad that he gets sent away? And now you look at the children of Yaakov, who were great tzaddikim, but Reuven, in terms of the pshat at least, goes and sleeps with his father's concubine. Shimon and Levi, against their father's understanding, go and commit genocide and wipe out a whole city. Okay, maybe not quite genocide, but it's not a nice thing. You could look and say, hold it, there's something very, very wrong here. But the greatness of Yaakov, perhaps, is that despite the problems, by the way, I didn't even mention the other slight thing that they did, is they sort of kidnapped one of their brothers and sold him off as a slave, but they got nice shoes out of it. So there was certainly an upside there. But you can say, after all of these things happening, so then perhaps there should not be. I know some of you are saying, "Ah, oh, they got shoes." Now we understand Mechirat Yosef. Yeah, not such a bad thing. But that was only half of you. I know which half. So the greatness of Yaakov is, despite all of these problems that happen, is they still remain a family. On the other hand, we can now understand why Reuven and Shimon and Levi are disqualified. Yehuda, on the other hand, the fact that he's right there with the Mechira as much as anybody else, even though you can argue that, you know, he took the murder off the table and at least had the Mechira, or you can say because of the way that he treated Binyamin, Yehuda at some point becomes king. Now, to come and say that Yehuda was already king at that point and they put him on trial because they were defying the kingship of Yehuda, so it's a little difficult to say that, at least in terms of pshat. And again, I'll say, I don't recall saying, I know a lot of people quote this and say it, and it's pashut, I just don't recall finding such a midrash actually inside, even though it became very popular in the Middle Ages. So now, in our parsha, there are a couple of things that happen. One is Yaakov is completely preoccupied with where he's going to be buried. Second thing, Yaakov gives what's called, quote-unquote, brachot to his children, although some of these brachot are brachot belashon sagi nohar. It's not the biggest bracha that you've seen, and that itself raises perhaps a question. There's something else that takes place in between those episodes, and that is when Yaakov reaches out to Yosef. And let's take a look in the first source. Yosef is told that his father is sick. Chole doesn't mean he has a cold. Chole generally means, certainly in this context, it means that he's already on his deathbed. Yosef decides to take his children with him, and they go to see Yaakov. But by the way, pay attention. Only Yosef is told, but he takes them. But Yaged LeYaakov, Yaakov was told, V'yomo hinei bincha Yosef ba'ilacha. He told Yosef is here. By the way, notice who he's not told is here. He's not told about Ephraim and Menashe. V'itchazek Yisrael v'yashev alamita. It's also, again, interesting that we just now shifted again from Yaakov to Yisrael. V'yom, and back again. V'yomo Yaakov v'yosef, kel shakai nirai lai b'luzber, it's kanan v'rechoti, v'yomo elai hinani mafricha v'biticha v'naticha l'kalamim v'natiti et ha'aretz hazot l'zarcha chorecha achuzat olam. Yaakov here is relaying that he receives a bracha for fertility. By the way, this bracha is absolutely transferred over to Yosef, especially if you look at the bracha that Yosef gets a little later on. But he mentions this, but he also mentions that, you know, he's given the land of Israel as well. These are basically the two brachot which is coming again and again. Your children will be a great nation and you will have the land of Israel. Yaakov tells over this, but he says something now very interesting in terms of the land. Va'ata, shnei v'necha hodim l'cha be'eretz Mitzrayim, adbu'i alecha Mitzrayim, and lihem, that these two children who are already born to you, they are mine. What does it mean, lihem? These are mine. Ephraim u'Menashe k'Reuven v'Shimon yihuli. So what just now happened, and maybe there are various ways to explain it, but we're going to say it in the most straightforward, simplest way, especially understanding the context is the land of Israel belongs to Yaakov. He's saying that I am going to treat your children as if they're my children, but what does effectively this do, especially when he says it's only these two and not subsequent children? He's saying I'm giving you a double portion. Right? That's straight off. You were getting the double portion of the land of Israel, which means instead of there being one tribe of Yosef, now there are two tribes of Ephraim and Menashe. Ephraim and Menashe, Kiruve and Mishimon. Ephraim and Menashe are going to be treated by me as if they are Reuven and Shimon. The others then will have to, if there are others, will have to be subdivided within those two tribes. And then he goes back to what I said was one of the major issues which keeps coming up, and that is one of burial. The So that may very well be an apology for, you know, I'm asking you to go and bury me in the Maridah Machpelah, but when it came to your mother, I didn't. We spoke about that, I think, last year or 2 years ago. So we skipped that. Vayar Yisrael et b'nei Yosef. Now he takes a look and he sees Yosef's children. Vayomer mi'ela. He says, who are they? So now, anybody want to venture pshat? You want to tell me what pshat is? So I already set you up a little bit on this, which was totally unfair of me. So how did I already set you up? He doesn't know they're coming. He looks around. He sees they're there, so he doesn't know who they are. Okay, that would be one thing. What else can you say in terms of pshat? You can say that he doesn't recognize them for a very simple reason. What?
They're like Egyptians.
Why doesn't he see them? So you can say that they dress like Egyptians. So I searched around to somebody to say that. So we found the Malbim says it in source number 8. Vayar Yisrael malbushei ha'ivrim hayu mishunim malbushei ha'mitzrim. The Jews dressed different from the Egyptians. The Yosef shehaya karov lemalchut, Yosef, who had a sensitive political position, v'chein banav hayu lovshim kimalbushei sarei Mitzrayim. So Yosef and his children had to dress this particular part because that's the role that they ended up playing. So that would be the, again, this is certainly a possibility in what I would call pshat. So far I've said two things. One, he doesn't know they're there. Although it's a little interesting because he's giving them this great bracha, but he doesn't know them. He's giving this great bracha, he doesn't see them. He's giving this bracha, he doesn't recognize them. Although there's another thing we can say, and that's immediately afterwards. Pasuk Tet, Vayomi Yosef El Aviv, Banayim, Asher Natan Li Elokim Bazeh. I bolded the Bazeh. What does it mean, Bazeh? These are my children. These are my Egyptian-raised children. What are you expecting? How are they going to dress? So the Bazeh here, I think, really does support the Malbim's contention. Vayomar, Yaakov accepts this. Kochanei Leiv, Avarchem. Bring them to me, and I'm going to bless them. V'nei Yisrael kovdu mizokin lo yuchal lerot. And Yaakov's eyes were very heavy because he was elderly and he couldn't see. So hold it a second. If he couldn't see, now we have a third reason why he wouldn't recognize them. He can't see. So maybe we jump the gun a little bit by giving earlier interpretations when we're told right here we couldn't see. Although the Midrashim are not really happy with the answer that I just now gave. So now we have three different possibilities in terms of what we would call pshat. Even those who say he was heavy, he couldn't see, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's blind. It could be that he doesn't focus properly. His eyes are not what they should be, but he sees there are people there. It's in a general sense, not in a specific sense. But as I said, we have three different possibilities right now as far as pshat goes. What was the first one? I already forgot. Okay, Egyptian clothing. What else did we suggest? He doesn't know that they're there. He doesn't know that they're there at all. What else did we suggest? That he can't see. So we have three different, or maybe we can even put some of them together, right? They're not mutually exclusive explanations. We have three different explanations why Yaakov does not recognize the...
Wasn't one of those children studying by his grandfather all the time and he would know who he is?
It could be. I just don't remember seeing that in the Chumash.
And the Midrash, you're saying?
Yeah.
This whole section is referring to him as Israel, is that...
Well, it goes back and forth.
Yeah, but that part about...
Look, whenever it says Yisrael, then our sense always is going to be that there's something national going on instead of just personal.
Why weren't any brothers informed early on like Yosef was?
Okay.
Presumably,
again, so there's a couple of issues. One issue is going to be the one of burial and who's going to be the one who's going to be able to carry it out. And that again, I'm dealing with the earlier section, and that Yosef is the one who has the most power. Two, he could be treating Yosef as the firstborn, whether he is or not. Okay, you're the one who calls him in, and there's not equality over here. Even as we move on, there's still not equality. And even though Yehud is going to end up getting Malchut, Yosef is still the one who's considered to be the firstborn.
But Yosef didn't call to him, his attendants did.
Right, so the question is how he gets that information. Which means, is there a summoning of? Was there a message sent, or just they have inside information? Okay, I accept the question. When he finally blesses them, first in Tetvav, Vayivarech et Yosef. He blesses Yosef first. Vayomer Elokim asher hitalchul avotai lefanav Avram Yitzchak v'Avram Yitzchak Elokim arei oti m'odi ad yom hazeh hamalach ha'goel oti mikora yevarecha tin arim. So it's very interesting. What's a very good blessing to give to Yosef? He's blessing his children. Vayikor b'hem shmi v'shem avotai Avram Yitzchak v'idgul arov b'kerev aretz. That's a bracha he gives to Yosef directly, but indirectly to the children. Now, we're going to skip a little bit, but he finally gives the bracha to the children. We'll go to Pasukav. Vayivarechem, he blesses them. Vayomahu leimor, b'cho yivarech Yisrael leimor yisim chalakim v'chayim v'chim nashe. The blessing he gives them is that, you know, God, the way that the people should bless is that we should bless you should be like Ephraim and Menashe. So I'm going to say one thing about this, and then we're going to go back to what I think is a larger issue here. If I put the two things together, Ephraim and Menashe, Kiruvim v'Shimon Yuli, and you should bless your children like Ephraim and Menashe. Now, I don't have to put them together. I can keep them separate. I could say one thing is only dealing with the question of inheritance, that Yosef gets a double portion. Another thing is bless them. People should be like Ephraim and Menashe. But what is there special about Ephraim and Menashe? Quite the opposite is true. Again, we see he doesn't recognize them. And we're going to find the Midrashim are actually quite disturbed, or they think that he finds something disturbing. I would make a very simple suggestion right now, and that is that in the general world, that means except for Jews, everybody believes that there's something which is called evolution. So just in case you're going to misunderstand this statement, Jews can also believe there's evolution. That's fine. I mean, the evolutionary process and so on, we've become far and far and far more impressive in terms of the ways that we can destroy one another. You know, that's probably the main thing that we've really have accomplished over the last couple hundred years. We can kill one another far more efficiently than we were able to do a couple hundred years ago. But is there also an evolutionary process in terms of spirituality? I mean, do we have this sense that as we move onwards, that we are getting more and more spiritual, more and more sensitive, more and more elevated, and the world is moving on? Because when it comes to that, Judaism has a counter-feeling, and the counter-feeling is that ever since Sinai that we have a devolution going on, which means we have evolution perhaps in terms of all kinds of realms. Again, fine with that, because that's... I mean, this is one of the reasons why sometimes when people speak about science and Torah or whatever, they get completely confused because they're talking two different languages. When Jews are talking about a devolutionary process, it's because generally the sense that we have... I remember once... When I was in Rabbi Soloveitchik's class, he mentioned something about the Vilna Gaon, and he said to us, the guys in the class, he goes, "No, you think I'm the Rav, you think I'm special, and so on." He said, "Realize if I was in the time of the Vilna Gaon, they wouldn't let me sweep up the floor on Erev Shabbos." He goes, "I wouldn't be on a high enough level to." And he was being sincere. He's being absolutely sincere. Is that he remembers what his grandfather was like, and his grandfather would speak in reverence about his grandfather, and his grandfather going back to Rav Chaim Volozhin, Rav Chaim Volozhin speaking about the Vilna Gaon. There is this constant sense that we have as we move on that there is some kind of a devolution, if you will, in terms of spirituality and so on. The bracha that takes place over here, that may you be like Ephraim and Menashe, they succeed in being like the previous generation. Ephraim and Menashe, Keruvin v'Shimon, that normally, even though there is going to be, if you want to call it a generation gap, if you want to call it a distancing, you want to call it that there's going to be a devolution. No, over here it stops. That Ephraim and Menashe, and the important thing is, Ephraim and Menashe, despite the fact that they're raised in Egypt, these are the children that God gave me here, despite the fact that Yaakov may look at them and not recognize them, they look how assimilated they look, and look how Egyptian they look, but despite the fact that they are being raised far away from Avraham's home, far away from Avraham's vision, and the other children were raised on Yaakov's lap, and the other children are raised in the land of Israel. Other children were raised knowing Yitzchak still, okay, moving back one generation. Yitzchak was still alive during the time of the sale. The other children are raised differently, and to say that Yosef's children succeed in being like Reuven and Shimon, that means over here there is no generation gap. And that's the bracha we give our children. Let there be no generation gap over here. Let the values that the parents have be the exact same value with the children have. That there be no separation over here. Okay. So pause there for a second, and I want to go back. Because Rashi and various midrashim are going to introduce something which are a little bit more ominous. ominous. Let's start with the Targum Yonatan in source number 2. Vayar Yisrael b'nei Yosef v'yomer. Now, what did the pasuk actually say? Mi ele. So how does the Targum understand it? Vayar Yisrael b'nav shel Yosef v'yomer mimi noldu lecha ele. Yeah, who's their mother? So this is an interesting scene. This is the elderly grandfather meeting his grandchildren and saying, who's the wife that you married that gave you these children? And now we can start. Look, to put it into contemporary terms, you ask, is she Jewish, or can I see the conversion papers, or what's going on? To put it in those terms, it's a little funny to speak in terms of conversion, although it is interesting that both Yosef and Moshe, who theoretically married foreign women, they both married daughters of rabbis. Well, or Kohanim. No, I'm saying there is something interesting there that, I can't marry the daughter of a Jew. Let me at least marry somebody who's a Kohen. The question is what Kohen means by Yitro, Kohen Midyon, what Kohen means by Potiphera. Does it mean just a leader? Does it mean some kind of a priest? Does it mean somebody with some kind of religion? Because you could say it's even worse, that if these people are priests, that means priests of some kind of Odazar. But it is interesting. So if I really ask the question, I know that someone over here is going to quote me in Midrash, what are you talking about? Osnat was the daughter of Potiphera, who was a Kohen, right, in Egypt. No, he really married the daughter of Dina, who got kicked out of the house, and she wandered around, and nobody wanted to adopt her, and she ended up in Egypt, and Potiphar adopted her, and therefore the Osa. This is, again, the wonderful world of the Midrash that works with the theory of conservation of characters. So it's a very nice idea, but it just really doesn't seem to. Again, it's nice. What? If you want to say pshat, it's not necessarily pshat, and that's what makes this targum so interesting. Who are these children? Yeah, but no, who are these children in a different way than you think? Who are these children? Who's their mother? Okay, which is of course right. Any problems with the children, you blame on the mother. Okay. So, let's continue.
I don't see why that should have made a difference at that stage. I mean, it's clearly a patrilineal society. Clearly
there we go, patrilineal society.
Right, right. Why should this make a difference?
Right, but in terms of giving the bracha and giving this extra. Source number 3, the Midrash Agadah. Vayar Yisrael b'nei Yosef, Ra'av Ratza Levarchan. He sees them and he wants to give them a bracha. But then something happens, and we'll see Rashi cites this. Nistalkami menu shchina. Suddenly Yaakov loses his clairvoyance. He loses his ability. Now, this is something we're told 3 different times in this parsha. You can go look. That's your homework. You can look for the other 2 times. One of them is very, actually, I think the other 2 are very famous. This is the one which is not as famous as the other 2. He says, Nistakami menu shchina. He loses his shchina. Kishira Yaakov kach. When Yaakov sees, what does he see? He sees that he can't see. But we're not talking about physically seeing. We're seeing Yaakov's ability to see the future. Then, it could anyway be that somebody near death, as they cease to be a physical being, becomes more of a spiritual being, and Yaakov, who anyway is an Avi, is able to see all kinds of spiritual things, but suddenly that gets shut down and that causes concern. He says there must be something very wrong with these children, which now goes back, okay, who are they? Who's their mother? Where they come from? There's something terribly wrong over here. This, by the way, is not necessarily an expression of he doesn't like the fact that they're dressed in modern Egyptian clothing. Right, that's not what bothers him. That he sees something spiritual. Shepsulim heim, she'enam ruyim levracha. They are unworthy of a bracha. Lefishan is takami meni shchina. Vayomer liYosef mi'ela. He says, who are these people? Klomar keitzad noldu elu. How did this all come about? Analo v'mar banai heim eshetan li Elokim bazeh. Melamed shirvielo asnat ktuvata. So again, this is a. He brings Asnat, and he brings the Ketuvah. What are you talking about? Not only was the kosher wedding, the caterer was kosher, and he brings it from the photographer. Everything was good. In source number 4, Vayar Yisrael b'nei Yosef, v'yomer mi'ela, shtei kushiyot b'pasuk. Echad, Ketuv Vayar Yisrael b'nei Yosef. He sees them. Lamata Ketuv lo yochal lirot, that he couldn't see. Va'ocha amar mi'ele. V'lo lamala amar Ephraim ben Asher k'Reuven and Shimon yuli. So make up your mind. He can't see them. Ephraim ben Asher like Reuven and Shimon. Then who are they? Vatahu shoel mi'ele. Now he says, who are these? Ela amru razal shetzofa Yaakov avinu baruach hakodesh ma'aseh yir avam ben nivat. that he sees a descendant of Yosef who is Yeravam ben Nevat, and that's what scares him. Shehaya atid letzei mi Ephraim, u'mashe katav vayar, that he sees beruach hakodesh ra'ah. And then he brings some evidence of this. Lekach, I'm skipping a line. Sha'al mi eile, mi uzeh she'atid lahadiach et Yisrael v'lomar, eilo elohecha Yisrael, bizman shemid shnei egle zahav, echad bedan v'echad bebeit el. Who is this person who's responsible for putting not one egel azav, but two of them stretched across Israel? You know, sometimes, it could be that you're disturbed by this, could be you're not bothered by anything, but when you get to the cheta egel, out of nowhere, they blame Yosef for the Chet HaEgel. What does Yosef have to do with the Chet HaEgel? They said that they took this thing that was written, and Alei Shor, they threw it into the thing, and Yatzah HaEgel Azeh. What in the, right? You all know what I'm talking about? What in the world does Yosef have to do with the Chet HaEgel? Why are they blaming Yosef for the Chet HaEgel? What did he do? Stop. What did Yosef do that he's responsible for the Chet HaEgel? But now, hold it a second. Just look at what this midrash, that in the future there's going to be another Chet HaEgel, which will be twice as good as the first Chet HaEgel. Because the first Chet HaEgel only had one Egel. He goes, I'll see you and I'll raise you one. He over here puts two Egels stretching across Israel. This is Yeravam ben Yevat. So therefore the Chet HaEgel is connected with Yosef. But I want to now pause for a second. Those of you who are interested, Rashi connects this as well. Source 5, Vayaris opene Yosef, Bikesh levarchem, he wanted to give them a bracha, v'nistaka shchina mimenu, l'fi sha'atid Yeravam ve'achav letzeit mi Ephraim. And then he goes on other negatives as well. That Yaakov is looking with Ruach HaKodesh, Yaakov sees the future and says, and who are these? Not the children in front of him. So it's very interesting that Rashi prefers this interpretation to the, again, we saw at least three different things we can say in terms of pshat. Rashi prefers this, that he sees something in the future, and I want to explain this a little bit more. Now let me go back to Yosef again. Yosef is a very impressive person. He's so impressive that everybody who meets him immediately puts him in charge. Now, let's pause for a second, because that is far more complicated. The brothers, and again, this trial that may have taken place, they accuse him of this. Oh, you want to be in charge. And that's why they get so upset with him, and that's why they put him on trial, and that's why they find him guilty, and that's why they sell him, and so on. But can we pay attention to something? Even though Yosef always rises to the top, he's never in charge. He's always number two. When he's living at home with Yaakov, he's number two. Yaakov is in charge. When he goes to Potiphar's house, he's not in charge. He's number two. Potiphar's in charge. When he gets sent to prison, he's not the one who's in charge. The guy who's in charge of the prison's in charge. When he gets in front of Paro, he's not in charge. Paro's the one who's in charge. Which means if you look at Yosef, the reality is that Yosef is never number one. Yosef is always number two. Yosef is the greatest CEO that a board of directors can ever hire, but there's still a board of directors on top of him. Yosef is unbelievably impressive. Anybody who meets him gives him the key, right? What does Paro do? Paro doesn't have to run the country anymore. Paro's off playing golf. Oh, one second. Okay, we're not going to go there. Paro's busy. Paro has he's got his harems and whatever to take care of. It's not easy being Paro. He's got pyramids to build. He's busy doing whatever things that leaders do, but the guy who's actually running the country is Yosef. And by the way, the same thing is true in Potiphar's house, and the same thing is true in prison. Yosef is the one who does all the dirty work, but there's always somebody on top of him. The brothers, on the other hand, accuse him of something else. What are they accusing him of? Hamaloch Timloch. You want to be the king. You're not satisfied, number two. See, I do want to stress something. If the way that things are supposed to work out is that Yehuda is supposed to be the king, who better than Yosef to make your prime minister? Who better than Yosef to make your number two for you? But what the brothers see is, or what they're scared of, is that at some point he's not going to be satisfied with being number two. At some point he's going to want to take over, and he's going to be number one. Now, does that ever happen? And the answer is yes. The answer is Yeravam. You go through the whole section of Yeravam. Who is Yeravam? He's number two. He's number two, but what happens? He becomes number one. And when he becomes number one, he doesn't want to let go. And that's actually when something real interesting happens. We have one king from Yehuda, who's king of everybody. And now we have the division between Yehuda and Yisrael. And more interesting, it's not just Yosef that divides. It's the vast majority of the tribes will come over and follow him and abandon Yehuda. Which means what Yaakov sees over here is this negativity coming out of Yosef is something he had never seen before, and I want to stress something else. It's something which actually never happens in Yosef. Which means the brothers' fears about Yosef was unfounded in terms of Yosef. But as far as the future coming from Yosef, there it's the, meaning the brothers see Yeravam when they see Yosef. Yaakov sees Yosef when he sees Yosef. But now when he sees Yosef's children, now for the first time he sees this negativity that comes out. I want to read to you an Agadah, which I think really, really captures this, and the whole possibility, what could have been and what should have been and what wasn't, which is source number 6. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin in Perichelik. Mashiach was actually the topic there for a number of pages. Omer Rebbe Abba, Acher shetafsu HaKadosh Baruch Hu li Yeravam bivigdo, that God grabbed Yeravam by his clothing, v'amar lo, and he said, Chazor b'cha, come back. But again, those of you who don't, your homework will be, if you don't remember, is to read through the sections of the Navi about Yeravam. Not only does he create a counter-kingdom, he creates a counter-temple. Not only does he create a counter-temple, he put guards on the road that they can't go back to, they can't go to Jerusalem. Not enough to only make a counter-temple and guards, he actually makes counter-holidays. So, he does everything he can possibly do to destroy Judaism as we know it. But nonetheless, we're told, God grabs him and says, Chazor b'cha, come back. Va'ani va'ata uven Yishai nitayel b'gan Eden. And I and you and Ben Yishai, we're going to go on a tiyul in Gan Eden. I don't know exactly where this is, but it sounds pretty good. Right? As far as tiyulim, there's probably even a Mayanot Sham, right? There's a Mayan. So, Gan Eden without a Mayan. Umrlo, Mi Barosh, who's in charge? Amar lo ben Yishai Barosh. Who's first? Ben Yishai is first. Ihachi lo ba'ina. If that's the case, no thank you. Now, this is an unbelievable midrash. First we'll do the simple things that you noticed, and then we'll do the things that you didn't notice. The simple things that you notice is for him to ask God, if God says, me, you, and Ben Yishai are going together someplace, what do you say? I mean, that sounds pretty good. Even the question, Mi Barosh, is an absurd question, because if you're with God and Ben Yishai, so really, who should be first? God should be first. So you ask, hold it, who's going first? This Agadah really encapsulates this negativity or this negative aspect of Yosef, which eventually emerges. Again, it's very interesting that in Yosef itself, we I don't think we ever see it. But by, you know, sometimes the princes are worse than the kings. One second. Sometimes the princes are worse. And over here, it seems to come out. And so asking Mi Barosh is an inappropriate question. The answer is a more interesting answer, because it should have been God. Meaning, what do you mean, who's first? God is first. Oh, you're asking who's first? Well, Ben Yishai is first. Which means that is, God grabs him. That's his sin. His sin is, Yeravam's sin, is his inability to see himself and his role to strengthen Yehuda, to strengthen the Malchut of Yehuda, to straighten out Yehuda. Who was the king at the time? It was Rechavam. Yes? No, I can make anything up now. It was Rechavam. The role was to straighten him out and to bring him back to where you're supposed to be. The role was not to destroy it and to create a counter Beit HaMikdash. I mean, something went very, very wrong over here. If you want to draw any parallels between the Beit HaMikdash and Gan Eden, which are reasons to do that, but still come, we'll go into Gan Eden. We're going to go for a Tiyul in Gan Eden. Who's first? Ben Yishai is first. No, that's a deal breaker. I can't do that. Now, right, that's the part which you noticed. What's the part that you didn't notice? Is that it says that he grabbed him by the clothing. You notice the language there? The language over there is, Shetafsu HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yeravam Bivigdo. He grabs him by the clothing. Look in source number 7. This is where we have Mrs. Potiphar. Vayehi kidabra el Yosef yom yom veloshimai le lishkavetz le liotima v'yika yom hazeh v'yavo abayit lasot melachto v'ein ish me'anshei abayit sham b'abayit v'tetpeseyu bivigdo le'mor shechva imi. So if I have to go through Yosef's life, again, this is Yeravam coming from Yosef, if I have to go through his life and look for a time that the Beged is the part of the story. Now, you can, of course, say the Ketonet Pasim, but let's be careful. That's a Ketonet. That's not a Beged. Over here is you have Beged, and Beged is actually quite significant. We can't help but notice, and we've discussed this before, but you can't help but notice the similarities between the word Beged and the word Boged or Begida. What is Begida? How would you say that in English?
Betrayal.
Betrayal, treason, whatever. Now, of course, I could say that the real betrayal of clothing is goes all the way back to Gan Eden. The real betrayal is when man steals what isn't his, when Adam wants to be in charge, I'll be like God, Ani ke Elohim, right? I'll be like God, which is the selling point, really, of the Nachash, which means not knowing his place. Adam was supposed to be number two to God, not number one. So therefore, what represents the betrayal, is the fact that now he realizes that he's naked, now he has to put clothing on, which means the clothing itself represents some type of a begida of the treachery or the betrayal between man and between God. On the other hand, I can take this in a whole another direction and say that the idea of clothing itself could be something which is one of the greatest lies that we can perpetrate, you know, depending how a person dresses. You can give all kinds of impressions about who you are and so on. And dressing up in different ways, you know, dressing as a king, dressing as a pauper, dressing in different ways. But it's interesting that the word beged is connected to the word of a betrayal. And now you can't help but notice in this particular context, starting with Yosef and Eshet Potiphar, I mean, when you read the verse before, the two verses before, Vayihi kedabra Yosef yom yom, day after day after day, she hits on him. V'lo shemayla, he doesn't listen. L'shkavitz lo liot yimai, he keeps his distance. Vayihi kayom hazeh, v'yavo habayta, lasot melachto, and on one particular day, he goes, v'ein ish me'anshe habayit sham bebayit. There's too many words in that verse, which means he comes, nobody else is there. And over here, of course, we have a famous machloket, if I'm not mistaken, between Rav and Shmuel. One says that he comes to do his work, and the other says he comes to do his work, with quotations. And that Yosef made a mistake by walking into that house knowing that she was alone there, which means, in terms of, is this good judgment? Do you go to a house where the woman of the house has been hitting on you every day and nobody else is home? Is this a wise thing to do? Those of you who are not sure, ask your wives. Right? I was once giving a talk, don't even ask me how I got there, but I was giving a talk once about intermarriage. And of course, the whole topic of intermarriage is a very silly topic. I'm sorry if I'm saying that. Because intermarriage is not the issue. The issue is interdating. I mean, the whole thing with the conservative movement now is absolutely absurd. Because somebody once approached me and said they want to make a hotline for intermarriage. What do? You call up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm about to intermarry. I need an intervention. I mean, that's not going to happen. You know, unless Jews understand that interdating is the problem, we're not going to solve the problem with intermarriage. What do you do? It's okay to date. It's okay to fall in love, and they say, "Oh, I can't marry you because I love you." I mean, it doesn't work that way. So I was trying to get the idea across that you need distancing beforehand, which of course sounds very racist and all kinds of other terrible. What, I can't date somebody just because they're not Jewish? Yes. Anyway, so I'd asked a question, because of course whenever I do these things, you have to do a round so they don't see it coming. So I asked if a good friend of yours' wife calls you and says, your friend is out of town and she's very lonely, can you come over to the house? Should you go over? So what was interesting about this? All the men in the room said, yeah, you know, she it's a friend. What else do you do for a friend? Of course you go. And all the women in the room were shaking their heads saying, no, no, no. Meaning, the problem is not that you drank a bottle of wine and there was music and no, the problem was you went into and you put yourself in a compromising situation in the first place. I mean, that's why I brought up that example. But Yosef over here, is this a very wise thing to do, to walk into a house where this woman's been hitting on you every single day and nobody else is home? Which means there's one of two possibilities. Either he's going there on purpose to be with her, or he's exercising really poor judgment. So those, don't defend him now.
He's
not interested in defending.
She didn't know that she was there.
That's okay, you can say that. But you can say that. But it doesn't say that. But what's interesting then is that that's what I want to come back to. Where the text says, "Vatitpasehu bivigdo," she grabbed him by his betrayal, not just by the clothing. She grabbed him by the betrayal, and that's exactly what the Medrash or the Agadah over here is using in terms of Yeravam. She grabs him by his betrayal. And that's why there is this linguistic relationship between this Agadah and between that story of Yosef, which means generally in Yosef's life, we don't find Yosef. Is Yosef a tzaddik? And he can even say over here, he runs out of the house, he doesn't want to be there, doesn't want to be with her. But the fact that he was there in the first place, is that poor judgment? Or is that even that Yosef is saying, okay, you know, I can withstand her temptations, I can withstand her, what is it, her wiles? Or whatever else she may be pulling on him. But over here we may be something negative. And I also want to point out another thing. Even though you say, no, Yosef's completely innocent and so on, Yosef ends up spending the next how many, if he's 17 years old now, more or less, he ends up spending the next how many, 13 years in prison because of this. So I have to then ask myself a question. Is Yosef, again, completely, completely innocent and ends up in prison? Or is there some kind of problem that he ends up in prison? Again, I'm still going to say Yosef at Tzaddik and so on, but I am pointing out, those of you who may listen and get upset with me, it's the Machlok and the Gemara, if Yosef is going in because he intends to be with her or not. In the end, he catches himself. Again, what does he see? He sees the image of his father, right? Super ego. He sees his super ego, he connects to his father's values, and therefore I can't see myself. By the way, most likely Pshat in that Midrash, he sees his father in the window, he sees himself. He sees himself looking much more like his father than he ever imagined, and he said, my father wouldn't do a sin like this, how can I possibly do this? And that stops him at that point. But again, that Midrash as well is the continuation of this idea that he really went in deliberately. Betraying his values, betraying his father, betraying God. He himself says, if I do this, I'll be sinning against God.
In the same way that you're intimating that he was that he had misjudgment here, you can say the same thing about how the brothers also saw something that we don't necessarily see. They saw that he really wouldn't eventually. Okay, it didn't come out in his lifetime the same way this didn't come out in
right.
his lifetime. But the seeds were there, and they sensed that he was looking.
Correct. Like correct. That was the next point. Although I will stress, by Yosef himself, we don't ever see it happening. But that's what Rashi is telling us. Okay, that's the scary part of Rashi here. Rashi is telling us that when Yaakov looks at Yosef's children, he sees something coming out that he doesn't see by Yosef. But the reality is, it ends up happening, which means Yosef ends up producing a Yeravam. Yeravam ends up putting up these two Eglei Zahav. Even therefore, by the Eglei Zahav, Yosef gets blamed. Poor Yosef. What did Yosef do? No, there's something about this which ends up getting blamed. But I do want to come back, because we do have to defend Yosef at least. The idea of Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David is the way it's supposed to work out. That's the tragedy of this Gemara that we're reading over here. Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David, let's go together. Yeravam, according to this, is supposed to be Mashiach ben Yosef in order to help the family of Yehuda, but it doesn't happen. He says, no, I want to be in charge. It's only when Mashiach ben Yosef can understand that he's there to prepare the way for Mashiach ben David, and he takes the secondary road, which means he lives up to the true Yosef, right? Who Yosef really is, and at some point, Yosef is always number two. One last thing that I want to come back to is in terms of Yosef's inner world and Yosef's inner life and who Yosef really is. Because again, even though I've pointed out some negativity today, the negativity is not in Yosef. The negativity is what emerges from Yosef, which can emerge from Yosef, but it's not Yosef himself, and that's what Yaakov sees here on his deathbed. So the other thing which I think is really quite interesting is, let's go to source number 9. Pasukav Dalad. Vayomer Yosef el Echav, Anochi Met. Velokim Pakod Yifkod Etchem. Vela Etchem in Aretz Azot, Ela Aretz Shenishba Lavim Yitzchul Yaakov. I'm going to die, and God is going to redeem you. By the way, this is really quite important, because it means that Yosef is absolutely connected to what Judaism is at that point. And as much as we get confused sometimes by various Gemarot and Midrashim and the Avot kept the Torah and so on and so forth, Judaism at that point is really one thing, and that's the Brit Bein Abeterim. That's the covenant that God made with Avram. The Brit Bein Abeterim is you're going to leave the land, you're going to be slaves in land which isn't yours, and I'm going to bring you back to this land. Which means you're going to come back. Yosef over here tells us 100% that he buys into this. Yosef may be wearing Egyptian clothing, he may be an Egyptian prince and so on. Yosef 100% buys into the covenant that Avram has. He continues and he says, Vayashba Yosef et Bnei Yisrael Lemar. It's very interesting. He doesn't, it's not his children, it's not his brothers, it's Bnei Yisrael, the nation. Pakod Yifkod Elokim Etchem, Valitim Et Atzmotai Mizeh. That when the day comes that you leave, take me out as well. Vayomat Yosef ben Mea Veser Shanim Vechanu Ato V'yisem Ba'aron B'Mitzrayim. The story actually, the book actually ends in a very sad point. Yosef dies and he's stuck in Egypt and the Jews are stuck in Egypt. The Jews are enslaved. But Yosef does leave them. You know, this is a spoiler alert. Okay, those of you who don't want to know this. We're going to leave. We're getting out. God promised it. Which means over here you have Yosef, you know, very clearly connected to the vision or the promise of Avram. But there's another point here that I think we really need to stress. And that's something that we sometimes forget. Yosef is a part of Egyptian society. In some senses, much more than we would like to imagine, maybe in the way that he dresses, in the way that, but he's never one of them. I mean, we saw that in a scene last week, 2 weeks ago, when they all sit around to eat, but Yosef sits separately. The brothers never sense it. The brothers never realize this, but Yosef is not one of the Egyptians. The sad part, he's not one of them, but he's not one of the Egyptians either. Yosef is someplace in no man's land. Yosef is an island. Yosef is by himself, but he's not one of them. If Yosef really was an Egyptian, you know, through and through, one of the most important, and I may be wrong historically, and if I am, then I apologize, but one of the most important things that we know about ancient Egypt is how much of a value they put upon death. Death was a very serious thing in Egypt. And to be buried in the proper way in Egypt, to be buried together, I mean, it was a whole, it was a, they were so obsessed with death, and the way that the pharaohs were buried, and buried together with all of these servants who more likely than not were alive at the point they were buried, because you never know, you need some good servants when you go wherever you're going to, and they were buried with wealth and so on. And Yosef's insistence over here is, I don't want a pyramid. I don't want, you know, this whole fanfare. I don't want an Egyptian funeral. That is such an unbelievably important point, because that tells you about Yosef's inner world. That means Yosef says to Bnei Yisrael, God is going to save us. God is going to take us out, and don't leave me behind. You know, there's a couple of things that, you know, some of the commentaries, and it goes all the way back to Midrashim, as far as, you know, why he's saying this. One concern is that he's still concerned about his brother's tshuva. After everything else, there's one last point that needs to be taken care of. Take a look at Source 11. Rav Chaim Paltiel, it's from the time of the Balei HaTosfot. V'yishba Yosef et Bnei Yisrael, Tema. Lama lo yishbi Yosef et Banav. Why the whole church? Why not just his family? Tell his family. V'yeshlom b'sifrei drasha otov amar ki Yosef amar lahem atem ganavtem oti mishchem ve'aleichem mutal lahachzir oti l'shchem. You took me out from Shchem? You need to return me to Shchem. By the way, just in case you don't know, he's actually making a stronger point than you may think. Look at source number 12. This is in Sefer Yoshua, those of you who have not gotten up to this in your Parakaday. Ve'et atzmot Yosef asher lu b'nei Yisrael mimitzrayim kavru b'shchem b'chalkat ha-sadeh asher kana Yaakov me'et b'nei chamor avi Shchem b'mei ha-kasita v'yu b'nei Yosef l'nachala. That, by the way, this Sefer Drush, it's the Mechilta. The Mechilta, we'll finish with this. Look at Rav Hirsch first in Source 14, and then we'll look at the Mechilta. Rav Hirsch says, Hein heim horidu le Mitzrayim, they took him down to Egypt, v'yabedavar zechet, v'haschut bidei lahatil aleihem chovazu. Yosef asked them to take him out in order to give them a way of doing. This is the last thing they need to do. They need to fix in order for Am Yisrael to be forgiven for the chet of mechirat Yosef. They need to bring him back. You have to bring Yosef back to where they took him from. So that again, that's the way the Rav Hirsch has it. But it's really based upon a mechilta, which I do want to stress is an ancient and important source. But a couple of things. It's a long mechilta. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Again, if you choose, you can accept to read this on your own later. But in the mechilta, it makes a comparison between the two aronot that they're carrying through the desert. One aron is Yosef. The other is the aron habrit, is the luchot. And when they start asking, hold it. So let's take a little bit where it's cut, where it's underlined. V'lo ele shoya mahalach aronoshi Yosef im aron chei haolamim v'yu ovrim v'shavim omrim mativan shoshnei aronot halalu. People would say, what's the essence of these aronot in the middle of source 13? One is somebody who's dead, and the other is the Aron of He who lives forever, which means this is God's word on the Luchot, which is inside. Why in the world would you put somebody dead next to the Luchot, or that He will live forever? For Am Lahem Hamunach Ba'Aron Zeh Kiyema Shekatuv B'Munach Ba'Aron Zeh. The one who's buried in this one kept every word of what it's written. And then it goes through. It goes through all the Aseret HaDibrot, showing that Yosef kept each and every one of them, and that part we're going to skip. But, you know, it's just in terms of an appreciation of who Yosef is, the Mechilta goes out of its way to really stress that basically there is an equality. To carry the remains of Yosef is to carry the Aseret HaDibrot, because this dead person was a living Aseret HaDibrot. So that itself is a wonderful expression in the Mechilta, but the Mechilta ends, Amr Lahem Yosef Avi Yarad Kan Lirtzono. My father came down here, it was his will, he'd made a decision. Vani Halitav, and I carried him out. Ani Yaradati Al Korchi, I was taken down here against my will. Mashbi'a ani la'aleichem mimakom sheganavtuni l'sham tachziruni. I'm making you promise. The place that you took me from, you have to return me. And that's the statement of the Mechilta. But again, I want to stress that Yosef over here, as a minimum, absolutely understands the Brit Bein HaPtarim. He knows they're leaving, and that's why he says, I'm leaving with you. Yosef has complete faith, understanding, trust within the promise that God made to Avraham. He's a part of it. He wants to be a part of it. The alternative he has is a great future. Dead people in Egypt had great futures. I mean, it was a wonderful career to be dead in Egypt. He had all kinds of slaves, he had all kinds of money, all kinds of gold. Everything is great. And Yosef does not fall for that for a second. Yosef doesn't want that. It doesn't interest him at all. What Yosef wants is to be, you know, this dead person, to be carried out in the desert. But what does Mechilta say? This dead person, he's just like like the words of the living God, Divrei Elokim Chaim. This dead person kept every single thing which is in the Luchot. And this dead person insists on being brought back to where he came from. He says, that's the least that you owe me. The least that you could do is bring me back to where you took me from. And I said, when you see now the end of this, it's not such a sad ending. Yeah, Yosef dies, he's put in an aron in Egypt, but he's not put in one of the places of burial. He's not in an Egyptian burial ground. He's not in a pyramid. He's not in all that. Yosef makes sure that even though they may have looked at him suspiciously, is he really one of us or not? Yosef in death says, no, I'm not one of you. And I just want to go back home.